This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
If there is right in the soul, there will be beauty in the person. If there is beauty in the person, there will be harmony in the home. If there is harmony in the home, there will be peace on earth. With this Chinese proverb, I welcome you, our listeners from the United States and around the world, to this special edition of the ICERM radio program. Let's talk about it. For those who are joining us for the first time, ICERM Radio is a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation in countries around the world. This program is sponsored today by the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, a New York-based nonprofit organization holding special consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council, which is popularly known as ECOSOC. As always, I am your host, Basil Okorji. Peace and blessings to you, our listeners, and our guests. And thanks for joining us for this important discussion on introspective journey into negotiation skills with Dr. Dorothy Balancio. She is the executive director of the Louis Balancio Organization for Conflict Resolution and also a full professor and program director at Mercy College in Dobbs Ferry, New York. In this episode, our esteemed guest, Dr. Dorothy Balancio, will talk about her mediation, negotiation, and other conflict resolution programs at Mercy College and at the Louis Balancio Organization for Conflict Resolution. Dr. Balancio will also talk about her new conflict resolution book, which is entitled Managing Conflict, An Introspective Journey to Negotiation Skills, a book that reminds us of the importance of introspection in the learning and practice of conflict resolution, especially in the development of negotiation and mediation skills. We are thrilled today to have Dr. Balancio on the ICERM radio program. Let's talk about it. Dr. Dorothy Balancio, it's actually a pleasure having you on ICERM radio. You are highly welcome today to join us, and we thank you for this great opportunity to talk with us about your work.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm thrilled to know about your organization, and hopefully we're going to be close collaborators in the future, because we're on the same page in terms of dealing with conflict, mediation, negotiation. Let me just introduce myself to your audience. I'm a sociologist.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a sociologist. I've been studying sociology for well over 40 years. I've been teaching sociology well over 40 years. And my main area and concentration of my academic research has been in urban communities, families, gender roles, and stratification. My PhD is in urban ethnic communities. I did a lot of work with family, within family, and the roles of women within the family and following those intergenerationally. However, a lot of people don't really understand where sociology and what sociology is about. I guess the more I study the area and the more I teach it, the more I love it. The reason is that sociology is like no other area. It's of any kind of intellectual work because it overlaps so many fields. It connects science and the humanities, and we work with intro as well as external micro and macro systems, and we're really, I guess, cut to the chase. We're people watchers. Mm-hmm. And there's a commitment to observation and to observe the real world, but also an explanation to the real world and a way of seeing if we can better it. So my PhD has been in this area, and I concentrated for the first 25 years of my professional life in this area. However, there was a major life-changing event. My 21-year-old son, I have two boys, I'm a mother of two sons, and my older son, at 3 days after his 21st birthday, was murdered
at a bar fight.
He was stabbed more than 13 times in his back, and at that point, there were 70 young people standing around and watching him. Mm. When that occurred, I became very changed, and I did not know what to do and how to handle the anger. So I took my sociology, I took my academic background, and for the last 20 years, I have now been working in the field of conflict resolution.
Which is really amazing. And we're going to be talking about your motivation, why you decided to switch, even though sociology is very important within the field of conflict resolution, and combining your personal experience with the death or murder of your son with your academic background in sociology. Bringing all these to the field of conflict resolution is something very phenomenal, and I'm sure our listeners will really want to hear more about it. And first, I want to say that I'm so sorry about what happened to you and your family. We're going to be talking about this in detail. And if you are just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Dorothy Balancio. She's here with us in our studio. And so you will have the opportunity to call in. I'm talking to our listeners, those who are on our website, those who have joined us on other platforms, those who have called in. This is going to be a public dialogue. So feel free to call into the show, add your voice to the conversation, and make your views known to the world. To ask a question or share your views, please call 323-642-1236. Again, 323-642-1236. If you are outside the United States and you want to join this very important conversation, you must dial 1 before 323-642-1236. Now, Dorothy, I just want to return back to your background. Your experience, all that you are bringing into the field of conflict resolution. I am highly ignited and excited about this opportunity, honestly, to talk with you on the ISON radio program. Let's talk about it. And you are, as you said in your introduction, the executive director of Luis Balancio Organization for Conflict Resolution. You are also a full professor and program director at Mercy College in Dobbs Ferry, New York. And for those who do not know you, you said it clearly that you have a PhD in sociology. You also have three master's degrees in sociology, philosophy, pedagogy, and many certificates, teaching licenses for conflict resolution, negotiation, and mediation. Now, as a professor and educator, you have facilitated broadly and trained diversified groups for over 30 years in a wide variety of industries, as well as participated in more than 50 professional conferences and many other academic and professional trainings and workshops, and name them. Now, I say that so that our listeners will begin to appreciate the person we have in our studio today. Now, to begin our conversation on what you call an introspective journey into negotiation skills. Could you please tell us why you have devoted, you were saying it before, but I want you to continue, devoted your time, skills, and resources to conflict resolution, and name them negotiation, mediation, community or advocacy, and all that. So why? You were talking about your son, 21-year-old, who was murdered. Does that have that experience have a significant impact that motivated you to join this very field of conflict resolution?
I think that we could look at it not as an impact, but actually it isn't just a mile marker in my life, but it was actually a change in direction of my life. When Lewis was murdered, there were, I would say, probably 70 bystanders who watched, and he was stabbed 13 times in the back, never saw his killer, and nobody came forward and nobody helped him. At that point, my grief and despair and anger, I don't think there are words to describe them, but I started to step back as the sociologist that I am and look at the scene and what could I have done, what went wrong. And in my opinion, it was, I did not think my son had the right skills. He was with people I don't understand in terms of trust. I don't think he was listening to his intuitive sense in terms of the values and his moral code. So at that point, I became obsessed, and that's when you talked about some of my backgrounds. I have my PhD, but I have 4 earned master's degrees and 7 postdoctoral certifications. Mm-hmm. When you look at my resume, it looks very weird, but what happened after Lewis's death, I became obsessive. So I went to Harvard Law and spent 3 summers working on negotiation and mediation. Then I went to Cornell and finished their labor relations. I went to NYU, did transformative mediation with Hofstra University, et cetera. So bottom line, I was seeking answers. And at that point, I was still frustrated by what could I do with this knowledge. The field of conflict studies, you could probably say, is a mutt. It borrows from sociology, psychology, political science, philosophy, and communication, laws, anthropology, education. I mean, it borrows from them all. So I said, what could I do? So I reached out to 2 very different disciplinary colleagues, one in political science history and the other one in legal studies, an attorney. And the 3 of us began 16 years ago our first conflict course. And what we teach is the basic emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. What I want my students, and they know from day one, that what they're going to learn in the course is how to understand and be aware of themselves, how to regulate their emotions and their motives, how to be able to control those emotions, and then empathy. They learn empathy, and then we go into the social competencies in conflict resolution, mediation, and the strategies for that. It's a journey where they have to look into themselves. What is your particular value system, and how does it relate to your goals? How does that relate to your attitudes? It's a core of what we do. From the very first day, that's what we begin with. And they understand that they all have an intuitive of compass. And what my interest is that they learn to read that compass and they learn to respond and trust in that compass.
Wonderful. And in addition to what you are doing with your students at Mercy College, let's talk about the Lewis Balance, your organization, for conflict resolution. This is actually a very important organization, and your conflict resolution organization is a not-for-profit organization with a very important mission, which is to promote, develop, and support programs that will help people manage conflict without violence. And I just want to underline without violence, and also identify and support candidates who will serve as future change agents and assist crime victims and their families in navigating the criminal justice system. Now, why are violence prevention, capacity building for social change, victim advocacy and support, the criminal justice system reform, why are all these very important to you?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of, we could go on forever, so let me see if I can be very brief. Mm-hmm. The Louis Atlantio organization really wanted to support what we're doing. It's not separate, but it's integrated. And that's why I'm thrilled with our meeting and the possibility of working together. What we do with the Louis Balancio organization is try to support through fundraising and getting people to understand what our mission is, and that is to select people who are very interested in mediation, negotiation skills, and mediation. Mediation is something that people have to understand. It is not to get involved in the party's negotiation. It's to be the outside person that facilitates their process. A mm-hmm. mediator is a neutral. They don't get involved, but what they try to do is set up an environment to make sure conflict is not negative. It doesn't have to be disruptive. Conflict, you can have a very constructive environment where conflict is constructive and can do very wonderful things in terms of social world. The social mm-hmm. world is very, very boring without conflict. But if we do it with nonviolence, so what Lewis's organization does is we fund students to take the mediation training in New York State. We bring a mm-hmm. state trainer in, and they take the 35-hour mandated mediation training, and the charges are between $350 to $600 a student. And Lewis's organization and others, we, you know, beg money all around to make sure that we get every interested student and the community and our graduates and our faculty and staff that are interested to be able to go through this training. We have the training every January at Mercy College in the Bronx, our Bronx campus, and we do it 2 weekends, the second and third weekend in January. We've been doing it for 16 years. Mm. And so we feed everybody. Lewis's foundation is fund, feeds everyone, and we facilitate the training. And it's not a simple training that you normally would get any place, because it's not only the state trainer. We've been working with Dr. Stephen Slate from the IMCR, which is the Institute for Mediation and Conflict Resolution. But it's also, there are usually 6 to 8 faculty members, and we spend the whole 35 hours co-facilitating with Stephen and working with the students. It's an incredible experience. The students that go through this are transformed. Their lives have changed, and they look at the world of conflict in such a wonderful way. Mm-hmm. So we feel really good about what we're doing, and I hope that we'll be able to expand it and codify it, and you know, share this with other institutions to use the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess that kind of takes us where the book came from and why we were kind of, people were asking us, please write a book. So we actually did put together a 20-chapter book on basic negotiation skills and introduced to mediation.
Wonderful. And we're going to be talking about that important book that you have been able to put together. And it's just an addition to the field of conflict resolution, especially for those who are interested in this field, and even policymakers and governments. Everybody can use that very book to make our world better. And I'm sure your students have really benefited, especially those you have trained, from your wealth of knowledge, and also your collaborators, other professors who are who have joined you in this effort to train people for social change. A lot of things are happening in the world today. And many people, in fact, that brings me to the next question. Many people see conflict as a negative thing, as a problem, as an obstacle to change. Whereas, as you were speaking, you said conflict could also be seen as a positive, as an opportunity for change. How do you explain that to young people who are listening to us right now from the northern part of Nigeria, where Boko Haram has kidnapped girls from school? You know, you've been training people in school, and you have students in many other countries who do not have this kind of opportunity to be trained for a social change. How do you explain that to students in Syria who no longer have a place to stay? How would you explain that to students in Iraq, in many other countries, that conflict could be a positive, an opportunity for social change?
See, first, you have to think about the word conflict. Think of a life without any conflict. If everybody was walking around and agreeing with every single thing that you were saying, it would be very boring. You would never know what's on anyone else's mind. So conflict enables you to clarify issues. It helps to solidify certain groups in terms of where they're going and what their particular situations are, internal solidarity when there's conflict. So conflict is not necessarily destructive. It can be very constructive. We compete. We compete with people when you know the right way or the right process to doing something. Says, okay, I know the right way to do something. You do it your silly way. I'll do it the right way. And every single time we compete, I'll end up winning. And so you learn the right process through competition. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be destructive. It can be destructive. And that's where we have to kind of look at what type of conflicts are we looking at. Is it just a factual conflict? Is it something, a conflict? The hardest conflict to deal with is a conflict of values. I mean, that's really tough. And that gets back to our introspective journey. What are our values? What are our goals? The basic perception that we have and the way we perceive the world, or the particular paradigm that I use in my classes and in the book, is it's called symbolic interaction, which means, I won't bore you with the theory, but basically it is, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. I first define and then I see. All right, I'm looking at the world through my own lenses. For example, I tell my students the very first day of class all about my story about Lewis and Lewis's murder. Because I'm your faculty member, I'm your teacher, I'm a sociologist, but when I talk about murder and I talk about certain areas, I'm no longer talking about it as a professor, I'm now talking about it as a mother of a murdered child. I'm talking about it as a homicide survivor. I'm talking about it from the way my lenses are. So if my lenses are yellow, I see the world yellow. If my lenses are green, I see the world green. So I'm looking at the world through my tinted lenses, which are my experiences. So those people in other areas with those experiences that they've had, those are the lenses they're looking through. And my thing is, understand what your lenses are, because I guess those lenses, I would not have chosen to be a homicide survivor, but I didn't have a choice in that. But I understand what my lenses are, so that's how I see the world.
That's very, very important advice to a whole lot of folks who are listening to this conversation, or those who will listen to this podcast that will be archived on our website. A lot of people are passing through difficult experiences have experienced death in their families as a result of violence perpetrated against them by other people, either state actors or non-state actors. Now, this is a common trend we experience in the 21st century. Most people who commit all those atrocities sometimes even put them on social media, and others watch very disturbing images that are really put out there, very disturbing ones in many countries, either by ISIS or by Boko Haram or even state actors. Now, these are very disturbing. I wonder how children who are growing up in this very 21st century era will really experience that, how they will take that. So my question is, how do you think young people who are watching all these terrible images on social media, either on YouTube or Facebook, that are being put out there by perpetrators of violence, perpetrators of murder, how do you think people, young people, will assimilate? What impact, what effect all these will have on young people, especially students?
See, and I guess that's one of the reasons that my approach is slightly different than any of the other approaches. First of all, I believe evil exists. I believe there are certain people, certain groups that you just cannot reconcile and you can't negotiate with. Having said that, one of the things that we need to look at is a lot of the experiences that we have, that we see or that we are experiencing that are hurtful and that are, you know, beyond description, horrific, is the fact that we're survivors, we're still here. So what we have to do is reframe. What I have my students do, particularly when they're in a very deep depression or very, very angry because of some kind of injustice, I have them do something called a happiness calendar. Okay, what's a happiness calendar? Something very, very simple. Every day I tell them, I want you to go through, think through your day, and at night, just before you fall asleep, you're in that twilight sleep, I want you to think of one thing during the day that made you smile. I don't care if it was just that you saw a leaf on a tree or some kind of music you heard, whatever. Something that you found that made you smile or made you feel good. And I want you to jot it down or in some way log it. And then at the end of the week, I want you to look at those seven happy moments that you have. And then I want you to pick one for the week. And then at the end of the month, I want you to look at those four winning weekly happy moments. And I want you to pick a monthly moment that was your happy time. And I'd like you to also do it with your friends. I've had so many students with many difficult situations. I know that when I was feeling sorry for myself when my son was murdered, some one student came up, I know what you're going through, and I kind of looked at them. And you know they did, because they had parents murdered, brothers murdered, children murdered as well. And the one thing that we were able to share is the fact that, okay, what made you smile today? What made you smile this week? And if you could get the people immediately around you, particularly the people you love, to do that, you will start to be able to reframe. I mean, even if your world is 7/8 horrible and there's only 1/8 to smile with, let's start concentrating on that 1/8, and that's going to give you the strength to move forward. As it turned out, my son's murderer, it took him 6 years to be able to get him to trial. He was convicted, sentenced to 25 to life. And 7 years later, our criminal justice system in New York State let him out, some kind of a fluke in the first trial. So I was so angry. I was mad at the criminal justice system and all. You know, but it's that old kind of serenity prayer, change what you can, accept what you can't, and have the wisdom to know the difference. Mm-hmm. And so my response to that is to find the happy moments, which is working with my students and developing the conflict and the trust, teaching my students who to trust and who not to trust, because evil exists, and then having them to own their own moral codes, and then to be able to trust that intuitive sense of right and wrong that you have. Mm-hmm. And that's why even your title, it is very intriguing, the whole idea of, you know, whatever your religion is or your theology is or your philosophy is, I want you to own it, and then I want you to use that strength. Mm-hmm. And you can see it through the writings of people that lived through the Holocaust in the concentration camps. Who were the people that were able to survive, come through it, and still maintain the humanity? And I guess that's what I'm holding on to. And much of my course, it's kind of goes back to another Chinese proverb, like the one that you opened up with, but it's, tell me I forget, teach me I remember, involve me and I learn. So if you learn how to reframe, if you learn how to start focusing on whatever blessing you have in your day, and then you start with the people around you to learn to do that, you can make a difference in the world. Because remember, nobody can make you love somebody. You have to choose who you love. And
that's
then when
right.
we talk about who the self is, let's define the self. Well, the self is actually a sum total of the people you love. So if you're choosing these people that you love, you might as well bring them into the reframing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I personally have a trust in God, but, you know, everybody's got their own, you know, whoever their basic social philosophy or theological belief is. We do a lot of work with the meditation in Buddhism, because Buddhism isn't really a religion. It's a way of life, because there is no God in Buddhism. And so, you know, I end up doing exercises with my students where we actually do some Buddhist meditation in terms of getting centered in the now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know
Wonderful.
If that's answering your question, but...
Sure, you did. Honestly, it's been a great enlightening experience having you here on the iSERM radio program. Let's talk about it. If you are just joining us, we are discussing with Dr. Dorothy Balancio. She is the executive director of the Louis Balancio Organization for Conflict Resolution and also a professor at Mercy College here in New York. We're going to be talking about your book. I know we've been, you know, mentioning a little bit about the content of your book. We're going to be talking about this in details as soon as we come back from the short break.
This program is brought to you by iSERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.iSERMmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners and our esteemed guest for today's important radio program, Dr. Balancio. We want to talk about your book, the Conflict Resolution Book, Managing Conflict, an Introspective Journey to Negotiation Skills. Now, as I was kind of going through your book, and also as a practitioner and someone who is also within the academic community, I know there are many scholarly textbooks and practical tools out there on conflict resolution, particularly on negotiation and mediation, from getting to yes, negotiating agreement without giving in, that was published by Roger Fisher and William Ory, to Difficult Conversations by Douglas Stone, Bruce Patton, and Shelahin. These are wonderful books on negotiation that I so much enjoyed reading as a student or as also a practitioner. We have seen different models in negotiation. And from conflict resolution, mediating evil, war, injustice, and terrorism, and also mediating dangerously the frontiers of conflict resolution, two books that Kenneth Clark published. And within the conflict resolution community, we also have the promise of mediation, the transformative approach to conflict by Robert Barush. We have Bush, Foyer, Joseph Foyer. And there is another aspect to mediation, another model that is called narrative mediation, which is a new approach to resolution. A book that was published by Winslet and Monk that I personally really enjoyed. I always have them. Narrative is very important. And the mediation process, which is a practical strategies for resolving conflict, that Christopher Moore, many people know Christopher Moore. But we can forget the science of adaptability in mediation and negotiation, which is a project of our Professor Peter Coleman of Columbia University. He was at our conference in 2015, where he actually exposed and presented on this very project that Columbia University is working on, the science of adaptability in mediation and negotiation. There are many other books that we can't mention here in negotiation and mediation, as well as many models of mediation and negotiation within the conflict resolution community. However, it seems that some of us, both within the academic circle and the world of practice, do often forget the importance of introspection in the learning and practice of conflict resolution, especially in the development of negotiation and mediation skills. And that is where I really want to applaud you, Dr. Balancio, and your colleague. And so I want to ask you, could you tell us why you consider your book, Managing Conflict, an Introspective Journey to Negotiation Skills? Why do you consider this to be a foundation textbook in conflict resolution?
Actually, you know, my aim was to develop a book that would be for, you know, Conflict 101, basically, but for the individual, the novice, that this is to help the beginning student, and the names you've mentioned. I took the Harvard program of instruction for lawyers, with Roger Fisher, and you will see a lot of the stuff in my work. I use the seven elements in terms of dealing, which is the core of negotiation skills. I happen to be a transformative mediator, you know, the Bush and Folger transformative, which is essentially, you're not looking for a result. You're not mediating to try to get to have a solution to your problem. All you're doing is trying to get your parties to communicate. To me, the best way to summarize it is to learn to listen and listen to learn. And the entire book is really to turn my students into good listeners. And one of the first things I blindfold them and put them into the halls. We do something called a trust walk. And they're put into pairs, and each pair, everyone is instructed before they go out that they have to have a story, a five-minute story, to tell their partner. And it has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it has to be something that they're passionate about and that happened within the last year. So once they get... We put them into two pairs, and sometimes they can pick their own partner. Sometimes I just randomly put people together. They go out for 10 minutes, 5 minutes, one person's blindfolded, and then they switch, and 5 minutes they come back. Mm. They're instructed they're not to sit down, they have to keep moving, and that the sighted person is directed to keep the blind person safe and to give them as wide of an experience as possible and to tell their story. The blind person, once the blindfold goes on, become mute. So not only are they blind, but they now cannot talk. And so we do this experiment. And when they come back after 10 minutes, the whole point of it and why I call it a trust walk is that if you are, when the blindfold goes on, if you're uncomfortable, if you, you when you start realizing that it's really uncomfortable that you can't see and you feel uncomfortable being in a hallway or walking outside and people are watching you, or you feel you're not going to, someone might throw you down a flight of stairs or where, whatever. When you don't trust somebody, you're not listening. And the big lesson you have is that if people don't trust you, they're not listening. Mm. And this goes back even to those, you know, you can kind of trace this back to a strategy used in the sex surrogate training, where when you're trying to talk about couples learning how to communicate with each other, and if they don't trust each other, they're not listening. And then when you cut out the nonverbal communication, the body language and the tone of voice, and it's really not just the words you say, it's the music you play, it's the tone of voice, it's the inflection, it's the way you've said, the way something is said, the facial expression, the body language that comes along with it. So what I mainly stress, and what we stress a lot of, is your body language. What are people reading from that, and what are you reading in others and the body language, and how true is that kind of communication? And as a mediator, what you're really doing is setting up and allowing these people to learn how to communicate successfully with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the negotiate, what you're really doing is teaching them how to negotiate. So what I start out in my classes, and I start out with the textbook, is each of these kinds of, every single lesson that I have, I try to give a little theory. I use the theoretical model, as you will see the Fisher, and you will see the seven elements for negotiation, and then I give activities. So the book is not only for the student, but it's also for the faculty member who would like to teach mediation and negotiation, and to help the students to move with these skills, but to really own them.
And you just mentioned something that I consider very important, that if you do not trust somebody, especially mediation or negotiation, lack of trust could become sometimes an obstacle to successfully resolving or mediating those disputes or conflict. Now, I want to ask you if you can kindly tell us, and our listeners, especially those who are listening, who are interested in ideology-based conflict, who are interested in value-based conflict, oppressive relationships, or fascism, how do we mediate such conflicts? How do we negotiate in such situations? And lastly, how could porridge to those kinds of conflict develop or inspire trust in a suspicious opponent, especially in negotiation and mediation?
Well, I think that trying to do it from with a broad stroke doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
If people are embedded in an ideology, that they're not listening. I mean, so the first thing is identifying the parties. Who are the parties and how are the parties? And are they in control of how they see the world? And are you – so it's communication is sharing information. But we have to get to this next level, which is comprehension. Can you understand where they're coming from? You don't have to agree with it. Can I get into the head and see what the world looks like from that point? Can they get into my head and see where I'm coming from my point? if you can't get to the to that point of comprehension, you can't get to the next stage, which is the contract and seeing what we need to, you know, what is fair between us and what should be done and shouldn't be done. So the rest of the argument is a moot point. So my point is communication is just sharing information, but if there's not the comprehension, then we're not going anywhere. And one of the ways I get at that, again, another one of the assignments I do very early on, actually the first class, is they have to go home and write a paper. And the paper is going to be two failed friendships, because I don't want them emotionally connected to these people. I want a same-sex friend and an opposite-sex friend. And I want them to explain to me what was the thing that attracted you to this person. I want them to explain what was the thing that, what was the beauty and the beautiful part of your relationship with this person, and then what got violated and what got broken. And then when we come in, we have to look at their friendship contracts and say, okay, did you have different rules for males and females? Do you have different rules for old people or young people? Do you have different rules for educated people and not educated people? Different rules for different races of people and ethnic backgrounds of people. And it's interesting because we now start looking at what are your rules? And once we understand your rules, how do you see these people? So if you're looking through a lens and you look at me and I'm a female, and in your lens, females don't have an ability to think, to write, to be educated and all, so you're never going to listen to me. We're never going to be understanding each other because I cannot communicate with you. You're not going to hear me. There's no trust. See, this came, Lewis was with six people that night, and he considered them friends. Those six people all ran and left him. He was thrown in the street and lived for between 15 minutes and a half an hour and died alone. Those six people, not one helped him. In fact, somebody was driving up and saw him, his body, and it was still moving, and they called the police. Nobody, the 70 people watching, nobody came and helped him. So my thing is, he didn't understand trust. He trusted people that he shouldn't have trusted. He thought he was, you see, I can't get in your head. You can't get in my head. So what do? I endow you with myself. So I figured I would never do that to a friend. So I assume you're never going to do that with a friend. Well, that's not true. So you have to step back and get real. I have to be, that's why the analytical part and the trust part. See, trust, I mean, it seems like a simple word, but there's two pieces of trust. The first piece of trust is, am I willing to open up and let you in? Okay, so am I willing to open up my life and let you into my secrets and into who I am? Okay, that's the first part, but there's a second part to trust. The second part of trust is, I feel confident you're going to keep me safe. Now, that's just as important as that first part. So if you think about somebody that broke your trust, real concrete. So think about it now, those listeners. Think about somebody that broke your trust. And now I want you to answer this question for me. When you found out that this person broke your trust, what did you feel like? What were you feeling? What was going through your mind when you found this out? I'm sure a lot of the answers I get from my students, I was angry, I was mad, and then I would say, probe a little more, saying, okay, who were you angry? Well, I was mad at them, I trusted them, and they said something or they did something to me, and I couldn't believe it. I says, okay, now go deeper. Who else were you mad at? Well, I was mad at myself that I was so stupid that I didn't see it coming. Okay, see, that's that second part. And then I said, okay, let's go a step further. What did that do to your relationships around you? They said, oh, then I started to look at everybody, saying, look, if I didn't see it coming from her, then maybe I should look at him again. Or maybe if I didn't see it coming in him, I better look at them. So you start now building up these walls. Mm-hmm. So now you have a set of walls where there are certain people you're not going to let in, you're not going to trust, and you have to kind of worry about what is real trust and what is false trust. And what I want you to start doing is stepping back and looking at your relationships and to try to look at the real world the way it is. Understand what your lenses are.
Mm-hmm.
And understand what you need in your relationships with these people. So trust mm-hmm. becomes a real key thing on who you trust and why you trust them.
Hmm. That's very important. It depends on the person you are in a relationship with. Many people are actually, when you take a sample of people and ask them if they would trust again, the answer might be no. Because of past issues.
Right.
So they wouldn't want to trust again. Your son, Louis, most probably would have, if he were here with us today, would say, I trusted these people and they let me down. And
that's what I want my students to understand. I said, not only let him down, but I bury him because of that. And I tell them, I says, I don't want to make the same mistake with you. He didn't understand that, and it cost him his life. So it's not a joke, and it's not a game that we're playing with dealing with trust. I mean, there's another example you could use for the people that are in these abusive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they go into these relationships where people are hitting them, particularly some young girls that are in a relationship and their boyfriends or their husbands are hitting them. And you're saying, why do you stay in that relationship? And then when you look at them, you could do as many wonderful programs and workshops and do all these things, but they're not listening. Why? Because you think about it. She's in a relationship where somebody that she chooses to love is hurting her.
Mm.
And so now I come and tell her, I love you. I don't understand why you're letting this person hurt you. She can't hear me because she, first of all, if I love her, she, first of all, if you love somebody that's hurting you, you think you're junk, right? So
mm-hmm.
she must think that she's worthless because somebody, I mean, she's allowing somebody to hit her and abuse her or neglect whatever is going on, and she's not getting out of the, choosing to get out of the relationship. So now I come along and say, but I love you, and I really want, I care about you, and I want you. And you look at me, and she look at me, and she says, I can't respect you. You love junk.
Mm.
So getting back to the introspective piece, unless you love yourself, and I don't mean in a narcissistic way, you can't ask other people to love you. So that's self-worth. So to get to that level of, you know, even getting to trust somebody, you have to get to the point where they have to love themselves. Because how can I ask you, Basil, to love me if I think I'm a useless piece of garbage? I'm going to ask you to love me because I think I have a future and I think I'm a good person. And
that's
I think
right.
I will be an asset in your life. So I feel confident to say, I want to collaborate with you. I want to work with you. I want you to love me and I want to learn how to love you.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So
mm-hmm.
you can't do that if I think I'm useless. So the first thing before you even can get to any of those levels is I need to have self-worth. I have to know and appreciate myself. Once I can own that and appreciate myself, then I can maybe start thinking about appreciating the other. The way I raise an issue, let's say beginning to raise an issue in a situation. Okay, the first thing I tell everyone to do is if you're in a conflict and you need to raise an issue, okay, the first thing I say is, what do you and this person, why? And I tell my students, the first thing is, how do we communicate? Pick your best friend in your life. I don't care if it's your mother, your sister, your brother, your wife, your husband, your best friend, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Think of that person. And then answer me this question. Give me three reasons why that person is lucky to have you in their life. Okay? Why is that person lucky to have, and give me three reasons. Focus on the way you guys communicate. Give me three reasons on why that person, it's kind of like that old movie, those people who know the old American movies, It's a Wonderful Life. If I wasn't here, what would, you know, that person would be less of a, have less of a life without me. Mm-hmm. And now once they get, once you understand why you should have, appreciate yourself, own those skills that you have, and now it's why are you lucky to have that person in your life? And now we could go into what is the issue, you know, what is the, what did you see and hear about the issue, what did you think about the issue, how do you analyze the issue, how did you feel about the issue, and then we could begin communicating. And then we can start sharing information and then get to maybe understand each other. So you kind of get a little walk into what I mean by introspection. Before you get to communication, there's like 6 to 8 steps. By the way, you mentioned Columbia University. I one of my my areas of specialization came from the International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution at Columbia. I finished their program there.
Oh.
In fact, that's where I met Stephen Slate. So in my book, there's a lot of the Columbia stuff, a lot of the Bush and Folger stuff, a lot of the Harvard stuff, and a lot of the Cornell.
And I just want to follow up. Let me follow up again on something that you talked about in your book. You talked about self-awareness, self-regulation, which has to do with connecting with one's moral code, self-motivation and empathy. Connecting with one's moral code. I want to give kind of two examples or two areas where I think this is very important, and these areas constitute, I would say, the areas where we see a lot of conflict today around the world. And one is religion, and the other is ethnicity or race. And in religion, there are many moral codes. Each of the religious group, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, or even ethnic groups, they all have customs, moral codes that are a little bit different, but sometimes universal. How would we, in this field of conflict resolution, explore the use of these moral codes that are embedded in different religions, embedded or customs embedded in different ethnicities? How could we explore all that to leverage, leveraging on these established embedded codes to enhance our conflict resolution practice?
Okay. I, again, coming from the introspective perspective, the moral codes, the from the social authority, from the, you know, the established active passive receivers of our moral codes from wherever we get it, whether it's from our religion, whether it's from the state, certain ideologies, from our families. But the question I have is, how do we internalize those rules? Going back to our friendship contracts. Where are the, which, how did we formulate those rules? Why did we pick those rules? If you look at, let's look at culture and define it as, in a strict definition, a sociological definition of a normative structure, system of norms or rules. Well, we have weak rules about, weak feelings about some rules. You know, if you, let's say etiquette, you know, you put the wrong fork on the wrong side of the plate or whatever. That's, we have weak feelings. Those we call folkways, or we talk about them as customs. Then we have those rules that are, we call them mores, or if they're written down and codified, we call them laws. And we have strong feelings about them. And that's where our identity comes in. Like, if I believe that those strong, I have strong feelings about it, which means that I feel if those rules start getting broken, my group is not going to survive. So I'm going to be fighting for those rules. Now, I start internalizing those rules. Now, with the individual, we have what we call, are we passive receivers of these codes or active producers? Is there a way in which I can include those rules in my moral code, but now I'm going to look at them in a social consensus way and say, I see that rule, but I interpret it this way within the context of my relationships and my friends and so on. So what we're talking about is moving people from being passive receivers of the moral code. Here's the code. Here are the rules. This is what the religious leaders or the political leaders or the theological, whatever you're talking about, are saying. Or are we active producers of our moral code? Do I produce and direct my own moral code in terms of what I'm living my individual life by? And that's why the book is based on emotional intelligence, which is become aware of my self-awareness, my self-regulation, my self-motivation, what motivates me into action, what are my values, the empathy, how do I perceive others, and can I understand and feel for them, and then the techniques and my social competencies. See, it all connects. And what I'm doing is working at that real foundation piece.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain what you mean by your real foundation piece? Are you talking about the book that you have published? Or is there another book that you are working on that you refer to as real foundation
piece? It's all connected, because the book I'm doing – the book we are finishing that hopefully will be published, the preliminary edition, and it should be published in the final edition in January of 2017. But the preliminary edition, I'm already using a working copy of one of the drafts. It's a collaborative effort. I wrote the first 12 chapters based on the work my colleagues and I did for the last 16 years in the classroom, which is a combination of all those people you talked about, the Columbia stuff, the Cornell stuff, the Bush and Folger, and the Harvard programs. And each of them have very specific activities. Mm-hmm. And the last 8 chapters, I reached out to several other colleagues that I'm working with from different fields. On chapters, we have one of the UN. She retired from the UN. She spent 30 years there, and hers is understanding nonviolent communication, focused on language, feeling, and needs. I have another one who did it on strategies and techniques, and she's in the School of Education. I had another one who did it on stress and conflict and the relationship with stress. Have a chapter on bullying from two graduate faculty members in education. We have the negotiation and mediation from a psychologist and a political science historian. We have the adjudication and arbitration chapter done by two attorneys, and one of them is in political life. She's an elected official. And then the final chapter on ethics, we have it by the IMCR director on the professional ethics of the field. So what we did was I kind of made this an eclectic version of giving the introductory student and the faculty member a tool to use in their classrooms and to actually experience it. As I said at the beginning, you know, tell me and I forget, you know, teach me and I remember, involve me and I learn. So that's the basic philosophy of this. And we're working on a conflict two or whatever, and what we want to do is now get deeper into this, use appreciative inquiry, use some of the macro conflicts, and I'd like to invite people who are interested in contributing to this book to get in touch with me, because I'd like to make it a collaborative effort that we would use this as the foundation and then move forward into something broader. So I'm extremely excited. I'm hoping I'm going to hear from some of your listeners and some of your group, mm-hmm. and that we can make this happen. The
Wonderful.
Publisher is very excited and working and anxious to work on our second edition as well.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And if you're joining us, we are here with Dr. Dorothy Balancio, who is the executive director of the Louis Balancio Organization for Conflict Resolution. And she is also a professor at Mercy College, which is a school here in New York. We're going to be taking a very short break right now. And when we come back, Dorothy, we have a few questions for you. We got folks who have been testing in our chat box are sending some questions. Questions that I think are very, very important and relevant to this conversation. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you to answer some of these questions. We might not take all the questions, but you will attempt to answer some of them.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, listeners from the United States and around the world. Those who are on our website listening to this conversation, those who have called in, those who are listening on other platforms. Dorothy, we have a few questions here in our chat box. One of the questions that we're going to be asking you now is from Jean-Luc. Jean-Luc is in Paris, tested this question here. And Jean-Luc is asking you, what advice would you give to victims of terrorism? How would they forgive their perpetrators?
That's a great question. I have a problem on forgiving. I don't forgive my son's murderer. But I deal with forgiveness in terms of dealing with the idea of understanding and communicating, understanding each other and the contract and controlling. I guess the first thing I say, I believe evil exists, and I believe there are some people that we just can't negotiate with. And there is forgiveness. Forgiveness is in our own heads, and I guess the best way to talk about it is to reframe it. I couldn't be if you stay angry and hateful and revengeful. You know, the Romans talk about, you know, the whole idea if you are angry and want revenge, dig two graves, because one for yourself as well as the other one that you go out after. So I think that we can't get into the dirt or into the gutter with these evil people. But we have to step back, and we have to look at what we have in our lives and what we've learned, you know, in terms of our strength. I mean, we're still here and we survived it. So what am I going to do with what I have now? And so I chose, in my experience, that grief is not a destination. It's a journey. And so in my journey through this grief, I learned that what I wanted to do in my son's name was to try to see if I could help others not make the same mistake and maybe arm them. So even if I do it for one person, if I just help one person, then that's going to be make a difference. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I have time, but there's an interesting little story. It's kind of a philosophical story, and it's basically a social philosopher had writer's block, and he was worrying mm-hmm. about not being able to move forward and to do things. And so he was walking along a beach, and the beach, the shoreline, I mean, it just stretched for miles and miles. And it was in early dawn, and he was looking, and as he was walking, he saw a figure way in the distance. And the figure looked like it was dancing. It was kind of bending down and standing up and bending down. So he was walking closer and closer and closer, and as he noticed, it was a young man that was bending down, and that the... If you looked at the shoreline, there were thousands and thousands of starfish that had been washed ashore, and now the water was receding back, and the sun was starting to come up, and these starfish were all going to die. So this young man was bending down, picking up the starfish and throwing it beyond the breakers. So the philosopher looked at him and says, how could you possibly make a difference? There are thousands and thousands and thousands of these things. Why are you wasting your time? And undaunted, he bent down, picked up a starfish and threw it in, and then bent down and picked up a starfish. And as he threw the next one, he says, I made a difference to that one. So my only answer is that what we have to do is to step back with our pain, look at the world that we see around us through our pained lenses, and the fact that we're survivors, so we're still here. So how can I get that starfish, even if I help one person? How can I do that and do it in the name of love? I think that that's about the only way. I spend a lot of time in my book, and I do a thing in terms of describing the stages of communication to a connected mm-hmm. relationship. And then I parallel it to forgiveness. The injuring party and the injured party, and then how do you go through that? And then if it's not as extreme as your listener talked about in terms of terrorism or murder, it gives you an idea. Is this an issue that needs to be forgiven? If it is, what do I need to do? Because if it's a part of a relationship that you're trying to forgive and it's something that you could forgive the person, you know, it's like you might have the relationship like a string, and it might have a knot in it, but that might be strong. It might make that string even stronger. So you might say, this is what you need to do to get my have me trust you again, but it's mm-hmm. kind of like you're hanging up on the cross. You need to tell me, what do I have to do to get off the cross? So you have to look at that relationship together and figure out how to rewrite that contract, that you can build in a realistic kind of trust that both of you would feel comfortable with.
This is actually very important. I know, very difficult to forgive. And this brings me to the second question from Emeka Ojukwu. Emeka Ojukwu is from Nigeria. Emeka Ojukwu is asking you, is it possible to forgive without apology, forgiving someone who has not asked for forgiveness? I added that piece. So is it possible, if I could rephrase Emeka Ojukwu's question, is it possible to forgive someone who has not asked for forgiveness? And if it is so, is there any advantage of forgiving without even being asked to forgive?
Well, I see, you know, what he's saying, the aspect of the reason I'm forgiving is not for the other person, the injuring person. It's mm-hmm. so I can get on with my life without this burning hatred and stress and anger. Because that's what kills you. I know in my own life, I mean, it's been 22 years since my son's murder. Before his murder, I had no health issues. I mean, I had two surgeries when I gave birth to them. I had C-sections. That was it. After his murder, I've had over 21 surgeries. So stress kills. And in fact, I mean, you lose part of your hearing, and all that's related to stress. How can I alleviate the stress? Well, the stress is by trying to understand where the other person came from, even though you're not forgiving what they did. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you readjust your expectations of life, and what I did was, rearranged my whole teaching. I stopped teaching what I was teaching in terms of family and ethnic and urban, and started applying all that stuff and started teaching conflict negotiation and mediation. So what I tried to do is to renegotiate my relationship with the world in a different way now. And what I'm trying to do is to use my lesson and the way I see the world, and try to, I mean, I don't forgive him, but I'm still here, and I'm doing things in my son's name, in Lewis's name, and hopefully, like that starfish, even if I only save one person, I will be, you know, in glorifying God by doing that.
Mm-hmm. And we have the last question. I mean, there's so many questions here in our chat box that we could really ask you, but we honestly do not have enough time left. Again, if you want to ask more questions, or if we are not able to transmit your question to our guest, Dr. Dorothy Balancio, today, we promise you that we could give you her contact if she permits ours, so you can reach out to her on her book to really connect and procure a copy of this very book. We're going to be asking her, honestly, to tell us at the end of this very show how listeners could procure a copy of the book, especially those who are interested, those who are working in the field of conflict resolution or peace building. The last question is from Christopher Johnson from Florida. And this person is asking you, Dorothy, that many negotiations, international negotiations, fell as a result of the negotiators or those who have delegated to represent them. What advice would you give to international negotiators who go there to exacerbate the conflict instead of helping to resolve them?
I think that that's the, you know, the answer of all ages. As I see, in terms of negotiation, is to understand what your interest and your priorities are, and then to try to see, again, with that communication, can you comprehend and understand where the other person is coming from? Once you could understand the interest of each, you know, and then if you could even get all of the issues and prioritize those issues, and then maybe start working on, maybe we could negotiate which are the ones, we don't start dealing with negotiating the biggest issues. You negotiate with the issue you think you might come to an agreement with. So once you kind of get into the pattern of maybe agreeing with this other party, internationally, and you can set up some kind of an agreement, then you can move forward and see if we can then start tackling the more difficult. But it should be, the issues should be outlined, they should be focused, everybody should understand, you know, each other's, try to understand where each other's issue, what the issues are, and then try to understand what the core needs that are attached to each of those issues. Because a lot of it is a misunderstanding, and the fact of what I need is different than what you need, or maybe it's we need the same thing. I always do a little, I don't know how much time we have, but I usually do a little activity with my students, and it's kind of calling the orange negotiation, and I have a group of scientists on one end who need these oranges because they want to develop some kind of a serum for scurvy, and then there's a group of social workers who want this crates of oranges because there's kids that are in dire need of the fresh oranges, and there's an inability to get any of these oranges in, so they're now fighting over this crate, and they both want the entire crate because they both need it. But at the end, if they negotiate properly, when they find out that the scientists only needed the skins of the orange because that's where the chemical they need, and the social workers only wanted the meat of the orange. So essentially, we looked at what was the main thing that bonded these two groups. Both of them were interested and care about children. Both of them wanted to help children. So we looked at that common thread and said, okay, now that we have this common thread, how can we now look at what you both need? And that's where how we come from the results. I know you're talking about international, but I did divorce mediation, and one of the things we used to do in divorce mediation, you know, is we understand you guys don't like each other, you want to start your new life, we get it, we get it, we get it as adults, but I would throw the pictures of the kids on the table and saying, okay, you both love these kids. How are we going to get through this so these kids have the least amount of pain? And all of a sudden, you can reframe from a whole different vantage point, and now we can start talking about the issues.
It becomes
a challenge and not a...
Go ahead.
No, I said it becomes a challenge and not an adversarial...
Absolutely. I am so much interested, I mean, when it comes to marriage conflicts. This is very important. There is a project we are currently thinking of, we want to work on. It has to do with mixed marriages. Mixed marriages have to do with marriages that exist between people of different ethnicities or races, religions, ideologies, and name them. And in New York, we have a whole lot of couples who are actually or currently enjoying mixed marriages. Now, one of the problems that these couples experience is lack of trust sometimes that are due as a result of or due to differences in ideologies or cultures and all that. And this is very important, and I want to steal some time now to ask you this question so you can address it. How do you think such couples who are in enjoying mixed marriages, how do you think these people could deal with their conflicts, especially before the conflict escalates into getting divorced? And now, to give you an example, where you have an Islamic person, a Muslim, who is married to a Christian, a Muslim from the Middle East, married to a Christian, American Christian here in New York, and different problems, especially political issues and all kinds of ideological differences could honestly have an impact on their relationship. So how could such conflicts, when there is suspicion, where there is a lack of trust, how would these people prevent their conflict from getting out of hand, escalating into even the stage of getting divorced? And even when they decide to get divorced, how would they really manage other issues that have to do with children and all kinds of issues around such marriages?
Okay, this is right up my alley. Again, that's why my whole thing is integration of everything you do. As I mentioned, my area of research was always urban, ethnic, and families. One of the things that you have to understand, and again, getting to that communication comprehension piece that I keep talking about, it's kind of communication down to the trusting connected relationship. So it's communication, then understanding each other, and then it's what is the contract that you have, and then who's got the power within the contract, how do you feel about that, each other, and then can you connect in a trusting way? Okay, let's go back. All right, let me make it a little simpler because, again, your example isn't extreme. So let me try to give you some definitions from the simpler, and then we could get to the more extreme. I'm Italian-American, and I'm third generation, so my grandparents immigrated here from Italy. And one of the things that I noticed, I studied the Italian-American families, five generations. I studied 72 families, intergenerational. And there was a lot of intermarriage, you know, outside. And it was interesting because one of the things that I found, and my subsequent research to that was I studied other ethnic and religious Jewish American, Italian American, and then the Black Americans and the Hispanics and so on. And what I found was when couples first fall in love, generally, let's use the Italian American example. An Italian American woman is, she. When we say we're having the family over for the weekend for dinner, we mean we're having 40 people come over for dinner because that's the extended family, and that's what we mean. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're come from the white Anglo-Saxon, the WASP situation, you know, you have the family coming over for dinner. You have 5-8 people coming over for dinner. So an Italian-American might just say, you know what, I'm really tired of this whole extended family thing. And they fall in love with somebody who has the exact opposite cultural background. Mm-hmm. And the one that is attracted to them is also, you know, might be subconsciously attracted to someone. You know, I come from a family that's very small, very, you know, very quiet, very kind of unique in their traditions. And I would love to get involved with it, you know, this sprawling, broad, extended family kind of relationship. Okay, so now the thing that is attracting me, the Italian American, to him is the fact that he has this small family network. The thing that's attracting him to me is my extended family network. Okay, so now we get married and we start having a family. Now here's where it starts to change, because now when I start having kids, I start thinking of all those traditions. The Christmas Eve with the 7 fish and then the whole extent, all the cousins and so on. So I'm dragging him to all of my family, extended family things. And he's used to, again, he's got the tradition and his was very different than mine. So now, you know, he's in my, and he always has one foot out the door and is always ready to leave. And I'm getting annoyed. You know, this is what I want my kids to experience. So now the thing that's drew me to him, all right, is the thing he was trying to throw away. The thing that drew him to me, I was trying to throw away. And now when we're going back to those things as we're getting into the relationship and we're starting to want traditions passed on to our children, all of a sudden, that comes crashing back. So my whole thing is that we have to get to that. When we talk about comprehension, all right, we can talk about the little things that are on the top of the surface that are issues, but it's really understanding what was my understanding of our original contract, what was my understanding of my original attraction, and now how can we compromise out of that?
And that's our very important advice to you, our listeners, those who are into mixed marriages, who are experiencing all kinds of difficulties. There are people out there who have got experience, who are able to assist you. You can reach out to us, to our organization, International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation. We have a whole lot of network, a whole lot of people who are working on these issues who could really be of great help to you. And Dorothy, it's been a great, great experience discussing with you, talking about these important issues that a whole lot of people are really interested in, and many people need to hear more, want to hear more on these issues as you have elaborated them. But because of lack of time, we do not have sufficient time. We can't go further. But we promise you, our listeners, that we're going to have this kind of conversation again. We will invite Dorothy back to the Eisen Radio program. Let's talk about it to continue. We will ask you to tell our listeners how they could procure a copy of your book and reach out to you, especially those who are working in the field of conflict resolution, negotiation, mediation, and other kinds of ADR. But we're going to give you this opportunity to talk to them on this when we come back from the short break.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back to you, our listeners, and our esteemed guest for today's important discussion on introspective journey into negotiation skills. We've been talking with Dr. Dorothy Balanciu, who is the executive director of the Louis Balanciu Organization for Conflict Resolution, and she is also a professor at Mercy College. Dorothy, we just want to ask you, because many people will want to procure a copy of your book or reach out to you. How could these people who want to reach out to you or procure a copy of your book do that? Could you share with them your contact information, how to reach out? If you have a website or if your book is on Amazon, how could they get this contact or get your book?
I will give you the address of the foundation, and you could write to the foundation. Mm-hmm. The preliminary edition will be ready in September of 2016. But I'll give you this address, and then if you get any people, you can get them to me as well. It's the P.O. Box 1515, Scarsdale, New York, 10583. So it's P.O. Box 1515, Scarsdale, New York, 10583, and they can just put, they want to put Balanciu, Louis Balanciu, L-O-U-I-S, Balanciu, B-A-L-A-N-C-I-O, scholarship fund.
Wonderful. And if you also want to get in touch with Dorothy Balanciu, you can as well reach out to our organization, the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation. You go to our website, you contact us at isermediation.org, www.isermediation.org. We want to thank you so much, Dr. Dorothy Balanciu. I would just want to end this show right now and thank you in a special way for coming to share your wealth of knowledge with us and our listeners. It's been a great, great moment having you. And we hope to invite you again very soon for another episode of ICERM Radio. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much. And good night to your, well, good afternoon to your listeners.
Thank you for coming. And finally, our thanks to you, our listeners and supporters, all those who have supported this very initiative, those who are on our board, members from many countries around the world. We want to thank you for your continuous support. It's been an amazing journey, and we enjoy having you people within the ICERM family. Remember, you can always come back to listen to this very show on our website, www.isermediation.org. In addition to listening to the podcast, you can also get involved. For those who have not signed up for our membership, there are many ways to which you can get involved in our organization. You can join the movement by signing up for our membership, by registering for our upcoming events, especially our annual international conference on ethnic and religious conflict resolution and peace building, which will be taking place in New York on November the 2nd, 2016. You can also register to participate in our specialized mediation training, the mediation of ethnic and religious conflicts. We also have forums on our website where you can share your views or interact with others and post your comments and expect responses from many people around the world who comment on our website. Join us next time for another episode of RSM Radio. I am your host, Basil Okoye. It's been a pleasure talking with you guys. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to ISERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ISERM Radio website, www.isermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ISERM Radio.
Peace to our world.
There's always a reason to celebrate. Weddings, quinceañeras, or just because I love you. Now, for a limited time, switch to AT&T and buy two Samsung Galaxy S7s for one great price. Visit your nearest AT&T store today. AT&T, mobilizing your world.
Limited time offers. Each line requires eligible port-in, trade-in, purchase, and service. Get minimum of $10 trade-in credit plus prepaid card in amount of device balance or early termination fee less trade-in. Fees, charges, and restrictions apply. See store for details.
There's always a reason to celebrate. Weddings, quinceañeras, or just because I love you. Now, for a limited time, switch to AT&T and buy two Samsung Galaxy S7s for one great price. Visit your nearest AT&T store today. AT&T, mobilizing your world.
Limited time offers. Each line requires eligible port-in, trade-in, purchase, and service. Get minimum of $10 trade-in credit plus prepaid card in amount of device balance or early termination fee less trade-in. Fees, charges, and restrictions apply. See store for details.